Track 12, and we have two feature articles for you this week, both provided by TNF Soundings. Next week, we reach February the 14th, when many people's thoughts turn to Valentine's Day. But how did it become so popular? St. Valentine was an obscure Roman saint, but St. Valentine's Day seems, rather surprisingly, to have been created by Geoffrey Chaucer in the Middle Ages. Soundings contributor Alistair looks back at its origins.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
The middle of February must be one of the dreariest times of the year. Cold, wet, and dull. And yet, it's the time when we celebrate love and lovers on St. Valentine's Day on the 14th of February. Oh, the happy, bounding flea. You cannot tell the he from she, but she can tell and so can he. Whoopee! That was a cheeky Ogden Nash Valentine rhyme. And then there's the soaringly romantic Elizabeth Barrett Browning. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach. And after that, there's the down-to-earth Aussie lover. No matter what you look like, I'll always love you, dear. Now shut up while the footy's on and fetch another beer. And there's always the old faithful. Roses are red, violets are blue. But St. Valentine, we do not know you. Although it's traditional that Valentine's messages should be anonymous, it's curious that although the saint has a day named for him, he still remains fairly anonymous to us too. So, who was this obscure saint who must be the best known after St. Nicholas? Little is known about St. Valentine. We don't even know whether St. Valentine was one individual or one name for several different people. So why do we celebrate him at all, and at the time of year which, on the face of it, looks most unsuitable? Wouldn't springtime be much more obvious? A feast of St. Valentine was first established on February the 14th, 496, by the Pope, who included Valentine among all those, he said, whose names are justly reverenced among men, but whose acts are known only to God. As he implies, nothing was then known about Valentine's life. There are a lot of legends about 11 men all called Valentine, many of which tell of the saint's ability to restore sight to blind people, all young women. But perhaps the most likely story is that he was a Roman priest, arrested and executed when he was caught marrying Christian couples and helping Christians who were being persecuted by the Emperor Claudius the Cruel in Rome. But why on earth should that be a capital crime? The straightforward reason is simple. The emperor had to maintain a strong army, but he was having difficulty getting soldiers to join his military legions. Claudius believed that Roman men were unwilling to join the army because of their strong attachment to their wives and families. To get rid of the problem, he banned all marriages and engagements in Rome, but Valentine privately defied the emperor and continued to perform marriages for young lovers in secret, so that the husbands wouldn't have to go to war. For this, Valentine was beaten to death and had his head cut off. That sentence was said to have been carried out on February the 14th. Modern academics have dismissed the idea that Valentine's Day was invented to supersede the mid-February pagan holiday of Lupercalia, which originally celebrated the foundations of Rome, but degenerated into something more lascivious. They believe that many of the current Valentine legends were invented in 14th century England, notably by Geoffrey Chaucer in his circle, when the feast day of February the 14th first became associated with romantic love. During the Middle Ages, it was believed that birds paired off to produce eggs in mid-February, and in his Parliament of Fools, Geoffrey Chaucer, the author of the Canterbury Tales, wrote, "For this was on St. Valentine's Day, when every bird cometh there to choose his mate." Even William Shakespeare's tragic character Ophelia called Hamlet her Valentine. But is all this just a series of old legends? It's hard to say, but people believe that they have relics of St. Valentine in cities all over Europe, in Rome, Madrid, Dublin, Vienna, and Prague. There are also relics of the saint claimed to be in France, Poland, Greece, Italy, and Malta, and in the United Kingdom, in Birmingham, and in the Blessed John's Dun Scotus Church in the Gorbals in Glasgow. There was even a St. Valentine's Church built in Rome in 1960 to serve the Olympic Village, and it continues to be a well-visited modern parish church. Whatever the truth, celebrating love is a happy thing, and if we didn't have a day already, we would need to invent it. And just like love itself, St. Valentine and his reputation as the patron saint of love are not things you can explain easily, but are certainly matters of faith and, for most people, a chance to show a little joy.
Alistair's item is followed by something completely different. It surely cannot have passed your notice that Barbie was one of the hit films of 2023, and it's competing for several Oscars this spring. But Barbie's creator, Ruth Handler, is not as well known as her famous doll. Soundings contributor Liz tells the story of how Ruth Handler, born in America to immigrant parents, built a business empire with her husband Elliot, creating the Mattel company and the Barbie doll. Ruth also had a second, lesser-known but trailblazing career as owner of Nearly Me, which supported women after breast surgery.
Hello again, it's Liz in East Kilbride here. Perhaps you know of the hit movie Barbie. Well, I'm here to tell you the story of the creator of Barbie, Ruth Handler. And you know, folks, I think her colourful life deserves the full cinema treatment. So, to begin at the beginning, Ruth's father actually arrived as a penniless Jewish refugee into Ellis Island at New York Harbour in the early years of the 20th century. He was a blacksmith, and you know the railroad industry in America needed blacksmiths, and they needed them working in Denver, which was one of the centres of that industry. So that's why the family ended up there. She was actually christened Ruth Moskowitz, but the name was shortened to Moscow. The family had 10 children and Ruth was the youngest. Now, the impact of that fact was that there wasn't much money for Ruth to stay on at college, and also her mother was in poor health. So Ruth, as a wee girl, was sent away and lived for most of her first 15 years with one of her sisters. Now, this sister and her husband ran a shop, and that's where the selling skills of Ruth really were developed. She loved to sell things. She loved to speak to people. Nowadays, you would call it people skills. She was determined to do well in her life. As I said, the door of college was firmly shut. But she trained at Secretarial College and found herself a job actually working for Paramount Film Studios. Now, it was there that she met a very talented young art designer in the cinema industry, Elliot Handler. She was concerned about anti-Semitism in the industry, so she advised him to go into business, use this middle name of Elliot, and let's see how they could jointly make their way in the big, exciting country of the United States. Elliot worked with one of the new dream projects of that time in plastics. So they started to craft plastic furniture, full size for people. That was what they used in their first wee flat. And then they thought of making it on a small scale as dolls' furniture for children to play with. They also looked around for the next great idea. And that's where, like many good stories, there are at least two versions of the origin of what became the Barbie doll. The first origin story is that Ruth was on holiday in Germany and she realised that we girls would rather play with maybe a more adult-shaped doll, you know, a doll that would be the shape of what they wanted to be when they were older. And she spotted, frankly, this adult doll with curves in a German shop window, and that was the first idea. Now, the second origins idea is that her own daughter, who was called Barbara, played with paper dolls and they didn't last very long, and that was always a sadness. So they put their minds together, Ruth and Elliot, and they decided to craft a doll that would be a more womanly shape. This was radical thinking. This was also needing a location to develop their industry, so they worked in their garage for several months until the neighbours complained about the noise. They were outsiders in their industry and they were laughed at when they first went along to a toy fair. But Ruth was always the saleswoman, and Ruth had ideas and charm that basically, as my mum used to say, could charm the birds off the trees. So they went along to a toy fair where children were attending in big numbers. They were sneered at by the manufacturers, of course, middle-aged men, but the children thought, what a wonderful idea for a doll. And they sold direct and they sold well. And this gave Ruth her inspiration. How will we market our Barbie doll? We will market directly to our children. They are our future source of money. How was she going to get publicity for Barbie? Well, once again, she just thought of ideas that no one had really thought of before. And American TV in the 1950s was always full of adverts for things, and Ruth decided to get herself and her product into a sponsorship deal. So they were there in the very early days of the Mickey Mouse Club. So in between the items and the small comedy reviews, there would be an advert for the Barbie doll. And Ruth and Elliot were selling direct to the children. Not only that, now it seems perhaps very obvious these days, they decided, why just try to sell toys at Christmas time? Why can't we sell toys all year round? And you know, that was their big innovative idea as well. Well, many parents might regret Ruth's success in that. The success and the progress of the company was astonishing. They called themselves Mattel, and after one of her partners, and also Elliot's initials of his beginning of his name. And within a few years, it was a multi-million pound industry employing thousands of people across America. But even from these early days, there has always been the debate about Barbie. Ruth always said, I'm giving girls dreams of what they can be. And that's why you had the scientist Barbie, you had the doctor Barbie. Goodness, he even had the astronaut Barbie, who actually landed on the moon in 1965, 4 years before Apollo 11. But all that talk about Barbie is about aspiration. Barbie is about giving we girls choices, was very, very much opposed by others who said, well, Barbie's shape is crazy. It's unrealistic. The hourglass physique, it's putting pressure on girls and it's wrong. It's attacking their self-esteem. And you know, Ruth never accepted this. She always believed that Barbie was opening up the ideas for girls of the future, and she was a role model in a very positive way. The expansion of the company was very, very steady. By the mid-1960s, there were 1.5 million members of the Barbie fan club. They were employing thousands of workers in multiple factories all over America. A success story, of course. A success story with pressure and worry of a woman with her husband always supporting her, who was in a man's world of high finance, high stakes, high success and high pressure. Now, whether that caused her to lose her eye on her company, we may never know. Because the next great stage in the life of Ruth Handler was the fact that the American tax authorities started to take a look at the company and they began to be just a little bit concerned about the tax returns. So the darker days were coming for Ruth. Almost at the same time, in 1970, she received a diagnosis of breast cancer. Now, I'm glad to say that many, many of the old ideas have changed. But here's what she said following her breast cancer diagnosis. I'd been opinionated and outspoken. I had strong leadership skills. I had been running a company with 15,000 employees, but suddenly I was supposed to whisper about what I'd been through. The experience was unnerving. This woman who'd been so successful and so powerful found a great challenge in recovering a life after her successful surgery. With all the money in the world, she went into a Beverly Hills dress shop and asked for a surgical bra. And the sales assistant brought her a bra and a pair of socks. This was supposed to replicate her original shape. She was deeply traumatized by this, also deeply angry, and decided to do something about it. I realised, she said, that I could use my knowledge and skill of plastics and soft materials, and I could perhaps help other women by crafting a range of better prosthetics to return them to their shape before their surgery, and maybe above all, return some self-confidence to them. Now, once again, the wonderful sales leadership of Ruth came in. She realised that she could mould the prosthetic in her companies. How could she sell it to American women? Well, first of all, very, very importantly, she spoke about her diagnosis and her recovery. She went on US talk shows and showed her womanly shape. She also selected the sales force for her company very, very carefully. And most of the first saleswomen were fellow survivors like herself, who understood the anxieties and understood the importance of gentle care in that situation. And this great trailblazing career as the Barbie creator, you know, was almost eclipsed by her trailblazing career as an advisor to women through her company called Nearly Me. Perhaps the most significant buyer of Ruth's products was First Lady Betty Ford, who had also been one of the early pioneering women who said, "This has happened to me. It's not the end of my life, and it's not the end of me as a real, decent, forward-looking person." So Ruth worked through the tax issues. They decided that she probably had been distracted by the cancer diagnosis, and she was given a fine, and the verdict was not proven and no contest. And she went on for the rest of her life to continue to be an inspiring role model in terms of her cancer surgery. to be a pioneer in terms of her sales techniques and also to be an example of a woman who had indeed overcome adversity, even if it was hitting her very publicly. She had shown she could help others. She never really made a bean from the Nearly Me company and the advisory work for fellow cancer sufferers, but it restored her self-esteem and goodness knows how many other women she has helped. So you may have your concerns about the Barbie shape. You may be worried or concerned about the fact that the Barbie is still going on. We may have important women. We have a Maya Angelou Barbie doll. I know, try and absorb that. We have a Scottish Barbie doll who carries a set of bagpipes and wears a very tiny, short tartan skirt and is a red-haired diva. I mean, she's closer to the cartoon character in Brave than she is to any Scots woman that I've ever met. But above all, you know, I think the message of Barbie is, don't just look at what people look like. Try to think of the real person inside. And perhaps I could leave you and finish my talk to you with the words of Dolly Parton, who wrote this song called The Backwoods Barbie. And our Dolly has often been considered to be a real life Barbie. But she's a smart woman, Dolly. And she says, don't judge me by the cover, because I'm a real good book. And you know, that's a message, isn't it? Let's see what's inside, folks, and not what is on the outside. And I hope you've enjoyed my talk about Ruth Handler.
TNF Soundings.